Coalition government partners. Greece's bailout creditors are demanding still more austerity, and the prime minister says the government has a plan to save more than $14 billion. The Obama administration has issued new fuel economy rules. They will require new cars and trucks sold in the U.S. to be twice as fuel efficient 13 years from now as they are today. The average must be 54 miles per gallon by 2025. At the end of last year, the requirement was not quite 29 miles a gallon. Critics say the rules will add thousands of dollars to new car prices. The White House says they will save families more than $1.7 trillion in fuel costs. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR's election coverage comes from the Principal Financial Group, CSX, America's Natural Gas Alliance, and Nissan.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Risk Management Commodities, Lafayette, Indiana; Milo's in Urbana and Escobar's in Champaign; and Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
WILL is your source for comprehensive coverage of the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. Each night of both conventions, NPR will bring you live reports and analysis on WILL AM 580. The PBS NewsHour will provide live coverage on WILL-TV. Catch our national convention coverage tonight starting at 7 from the GOP National Convention in Tampa, Florida. WILL is your source for in-depth election news.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus archives, so as you listen, keep in mind, we will not be taking calls.
It is a very human trait to want to be right, even more to believe that you are right. But our guest for this hour, journalist Catherine Schultz, says that being wrong is more interesting, it's more complicated, it is ultimately more revealing. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with Catherine Schultz about her new book, and the title of the book is Being Wrong. The subtitle is Adventures in the Margin of Error. And in this book, she makes the argument that the capacity to be wrong is something that is crucial to our ability to think. It's connected to some of our best qualities, things like empathy and imagination, and is a vital part of how we learn and change. The book is just recently out. It's published by Echo, which is an imprint of HarperCollins, and I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. Catherine Schultz is a journalist. Her work has appeared in many places: the New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, The Nation, Foreign Policy, Huffington Post. She's former editor of the online magazine Grist, and also former reporter and editor for the Santiago Times of Santiago, Chile, where she covered environmental, labor, and human rights issues. And she is joining us this morning by telephone. Ms. Schultz, hello.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for being with us. I think it's a very, very interesting topic. Certainly, it is true that we really like being right, particularly, I think, sometimes when we can say we're right and somebody else is wrong. And we do that in spite of the fact that that's not always real good for our close personal relationships.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I think probably the best example of that is the phrase, I told you so, which is, you know, incredibly fun to say, and most of us are very bad at turning down the opportunity to say it when it comes along. But it's also a crystalline example of how it's not good for our relationships, that attitude toward error. Nobody likes to hear someone say, I told you so, even though we all love to say it.
Yeah. Well, I think you explained that you didn't really set out so much. The thing that got you started was not really thinking about being wrong, but it was about this thing about being right and why it is that it is so satisfying to be right.
True. You know, initially I did get curious about our attachment to that feeling of rightness and why it's so satisfying, why it's so urgent, even over very trivial matters. We really feel this strong need to be right about things. And I felt that in myself, and I watched it at work in our society, and I got curious about that desire. And it quickly became very clear to me that that attachment to being right is a little bit easier to understand when we flip it around and look at our real phobia about being wrong.
Well, then, you know, why, and you certainly make the argument that being wrong is an essential part of being human for various reasons that we can discuss. It's actually a good thing. It's very much connected to our ability to learn, and that actually being wrong sometimes can be a pleasant, enjoyable experience, and we do like being surprised about things. So you can find reasons why it's good and why we really do enjoy it, and at the same time, though, it's really difficult to be wrong. It's certainly very difficult to admit it.
That's right. I think most of us have a tough time acknowledging, sometimes even to ourselves and certainly publicly, that we're wrong about something. And, you know, as we began by saying, I think that that difficulty is not very good for our relationships or for ourselves. And by relationships, I mean in the largest sense, whether it's, you know, between you and me or you and your coworker or between, you know, neighborhoods or cultures or nations. It just doesn't serve anyone very well to insist on being right and be unable to reflect on our views and how and why we hold them and to be unable to admit it when we're wrong. And yet that is, I think, the default position for most people, that we are not good at kind of readily embracing and accepting our mistakes when they happen.
Mm. What then? I guess we keep coming around to the same question, and that is, why is that? And is there a way of answering why that is?
Yeah, I think there's many answers to that question, but I think one of the most basic ones is that, you know, we tend to think that getting something wrong means that there's something wrong with us.
Hmm.
In other words, we interpret our mistakes as some kind of sign of an intellectual failure, a failure in judgment, even a moral failing. And as a result, you know, I mean, none of us like to feel like we're lesser human beings. We don't like to feel stupid. We don't like to feel, you know, inferior in any way. And because we tend to interpret our mistakes as an indication of that, we distance ourselves from them. We you know, deny them or get defensive about them or try to blame them on other people or what have you. And, you know, the problem is that I think that's a fundamentally flawed understanding of what it means to make mistakes. For the most part, our mistakes are not indictments of our intellect or our moral worth or what have you. And choosing to interpret them that way, and I shouldn't say choosing, you know, it's something that is sort of foisted upon us by our culture. Most of us do it automatically. But accepting that interpretation and failing to look beyond it, as I said, does not tend to serve us very well.
Yeah. Well, I certainly think you put your finger on what is a big problem with how we think about error, and that is, you say that the reason that it feels uncomfortable is that it leads us to think, well, if we've made a mistake, there's something wrong with us. Well, it also is the case that if we see somebody else and think they have made a mistake, then it means we think something's wrong with them.
That's exactly right, and it's a really important point. I mean, it's, you know, it's problematic that this understanding of error leads us to, you know, feel humiliated and embarrassed ourselves when we make mistakes and sort of deny it or just not cope with it very gracefully. But it's even more problematic, if anything, that this interpretation also means that when other people make mistakes, we tend to be really unforgiving about that, and we see them as being stupid or idiotic or careless or thoughtless or what have you, when the reality is, you know, the vast majority of mistakes cannot be simplified in quite that way. We can't just chalk it up to someone's, you know, sort of personal failing.
Yeah, it's all too easy, as you point out, to go from thinking that when a person is wrong, that they're, first of all, that they're stupid, but then it's not much of a jump to go on from the fact that they're wrong to they're stupid to they're evil.
Right. This is a very common and very dangerous slippery slope, and I think we all see it at work around us all the time. You know, when someone doesn't agree with your point of view, I think for most of us, our first reaction is a relatively generous one. We think, well, you know, that person just doesn't have the same information that I have, and if I can just enlighten them, they'll come around to my viewpoint. In other words, they're ignorant. We assume that they're ignorant. And when that doesn't work, you know, when you share information and people still continue to disagree with you, you think, well, you know, they're idiotic. They have the information, but they don't have the brain power to correctly interpret it. And when it becomes clear that, oh, you know, this person actually is pretty smart, then we move to assuming, oh, they're actually evil. They have the right information. They have the capacity to interpret it. And they are willfully ignoring it and sort of pushing this other worldview instead. And that chain of assumptions is, I think, both an incorrect one and a dangerous one, and a really sort of closed-minded and incurious one. It doesn't really let us get in there and understand, no, you know, this person disagrees with us, but they hold that view for a reason, and they probably think that they're moral beings just the way that we do. And so what's going on? Why do they disagree with me?
Well, and that's, and I think it's also interesting that the intensity of this these kinds of conversations, they can be equally intense if you're talking about something that does have a moral dimension, where it seems to be that there may indeed be a right and a wrong. It just doesn't stop there. It gets into all of those cases where either right or wrong can't be determined, maybe there isn't any, or those cases where there truly is no right and wrong, particularly when aesthetic judgment is involved, that one person's way of looking at something is just as good as somebody else. It's just different. And yet we want to argue just as passionately about those kinds of things as about the things that truly may indeed have moral dimension.
We really do, and this is something I find fascinating and in some ways kind of charming about human behavior. You know, even when we know that the categories of right and wrong don't apply, you know, I mean, all of us know that when it comes, as you point out, to, you know, essentially matters of taste, well, of course there's no right or wrong. You know, are blueberry muffins delicious, or are they, like, soggy and overly sweet and disgusting? I mean, come on, there's no right or wrong in that. And yet it's amazing how when you get people talking about that, it's easy to make people start acting like right and wrong are the relevant yardsticks. You know, I mean, you very often hear people, you know, someone will say something like, oh, well, you just haven't had my mom's blueberry muffins. And again, it's that thing of like, well, you just haven't been exposed to the right truth, the right body of information. And if you did, you would see the world exactly as I do, even when we know that that's, you know, manifestly not the case. And I think it's important to look at instances like that, because one thing we can learn from how quickly we can get attached to right and wrong, even when we know. Trivial when we take that same relationship to feeling right and then to hating being wrong and extrapolate it out to, you know, more fraught dimensions like the political one or the religious one or what have you. Mm.
Our guest in this hour, Catherine Schultz, she's a journalist. Her new book is titled Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Looks at why it is that human beings like so much to be right and hate so much to be wrong. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I got an email here from a listener who makes this observation. She writes more than once that she had heard Charlton Heston asked about the secret to his marriage, which was more than 50 years. And he always said, quote, it's those three little words. And after two-beat pause, he would say, I was wrong. And we could all, you know, no matter what you think about Chuck and his acting and his politics, you'd have to say, oh, I think you hit it on that one, particularly when it comes to our closest relationships, why there seems to be there's so much at stake. And there why it is that we argue over just the littlest, the least important stuff.
It's an amazing thing, and anyone who's been in a relationship of, you know, that makes it all beyond the honeymoon period is certainly familiar with the way that right and wrong become both really important and also potentially really destructive within our most intimate relationships. And, you know, on some level, the problem is just that these are the people we spend the most time with, and as a result, we're constantly making decisions together, whether those decisions are, you know, what time should our kids' bedtime be, or how should we respond to the, you know, our child's, you know, infraction at school today, or, you know, should we buy that kind of bread or the other kind of bread at the grocery store? And the sheer process of just having to constantly check our own intuitions and ideas and beliefs and convictions against somebody else's can be very difficult and exhausting. And, of course, it's the people that we need to do that with day in and day out who often bear the brunt of our desire to be just kind of correct and affirmed and accurate all the time. And there's something about your loved ones saying, no, you know, I hate that brand of bread. Let's get this other kind, that, as trivial as it is, I think can feel like, wait a second, aren't you the person who's supposed to sort of joyfully share my entire worldview. Why are you challenging me over something dumb here in the bread aisle of the grocery store? And these little, tiffs can arise and become pretty emotionally fraught. Mm.
Does ego have something to do with it?
Oh, ego has everything to do with it. Absolutely. You know, our as I started out by saying, we associate being wrong about something with, in some way, shape, or form, being wrong in a deep kind of personal sense, that there's something wrong with us. And conversely, we think that being right is an affirmation of our, you know, just general brilliance. Aren't we so smart? Isn't our memory so great? So on and so forth. And so, yeah, absolutely, this desire to be right is, it does, the experience of being right, I think, really does stroke our ego, and we've all had that experience. We have that kind of ha moment when we're right about something. It feels like a little miniature triumph. And it's really hard not to pursue that kind of triumph, even at the expense of, you know, every form of social kindness. It's easy to kind of run over everyone in our path on the way to being able to say, but I'm right, but I'm right, but I'm right, even when we aren't. So yes, for sure, ego has a lot to do with it. And I think to a large extent, our ability to tolerate being wrong depends on how healthy our ego is and the extent to which we can say, you know what, yeah, I got it wrong, and that's not a reflection on my overall worth in the world. It's just, it happens. Life is complicated. The world around us is messy and full of confusing data, and we don't always get it right, and that's fine. I'm still an okay person.
Yeah. Well, that gets at something that I think is really interesting, and that is the difficult position that someone, say, in political leadership is in. Sometimes people in business as well, but particularly in politics, because we expect a lot of our leaders, maybe too much, and we want them to be right. And when they turn out to be wrong, it really makes us unhappy. And at the same time, the person who has that capacity to stand up there, stand up in front of the whole country and say, you know, I really screwed up big time, at the same time, we really admire that.
We do, or we say we do. There's no question that politicians have probably the trickiest and, I would argue, the most dysfunctional relationship pair of pretty much any subset of society. And that's not just their fault. It's our fault. As you point out, we want our political leaders to be right, and that's extremely rational. You know, they make very, very important decisions all the time. It's really important to us that they have good judgment and that they get it right, and it should be. We also really want our political leaders to be certain. We're very uncomfortable on the whole with doubt and hesitation from leaders of any sort, and very intolerant of it. And unfortunately, these can work at cross purposes. It can be really hard to make sure you're looking at all the information correctly and achieving an accurate answer if you're overriding goal is just to appear completely confident and like you already have the answer all the time. So politicians are in a tricky position in that respect. And then, you know, as you say, and I share this opinion with you, that the capacity to stand up and say, you know what, I got it wrong, here's why it happened, and here's what we're going to do about it, both in terms of trying to, you know, ameliorate any bad consequences of what just happened and trying to make sure it never happens again. To me, the ability to do that is a sign of tremendous strength. It's a quality I value immensely in leaders, and I'm very uncomfortable with leaders who don't have that ability. But as a society, I would say we're a little bit conflicted about that. We claim to want people to be able to say when they got it wrong, and yet we very often take the opportunity of people admitting their mistakes to just absolutely excoriate them and pretend that, you know, anyone who has the capacity to make a mistake has no right being a leader, which is a little bit ridiculous because, of course, you know, they're human like the rest of us, and the capacity to make mistakes is pretty much part of the package.
Yeah. Well, you early on here, you present, and this is in the chapter, two models of wrongness, two ways of looking at wrong. One, which is the most common, and we've really talked about that, the one that people, that says people want to avoid being wrong at all costs, and certainly we don't like to admit it. That says error, bad thing. Mm-hmm. The other side, the one that's less, that's much harder, but actually when you think about it is probably the better way to think about it, sees something positive in error.
That's right. And in the book, I call these the optimistic versus the pessimistic model of error. And in the pessimistic one, as you said, error is just this awful, humiliating, horrible thing that we should get rid of if we can. And the optimistic model, by contrast, says, look, first of all, we're not getting rid of this. We can, in some circumstances, work to either reduce errors or, more importantly, reduce their harmful consequences. But mistakes themselves are here to stay, and you're living in a fantasy world if you think you can get rid of them. So let's start from that basic assumption and then think about what it means. And that more optimistic view tends to come out on the side of saying, you know what, there are many wonderful things that come about because of error or because of our capacity to err, and we should, you know, without just sort of kind of naively thinking that all mistakes are wonderful and great, because of course they aren't, we should accept that this capacity to err brings many wonderful things into our lives and seek to understand it and understand our relationship to it and respond to it better rather than just, you know, bury our heads in the sand and pretend we can make this supposedly horrible thing go away.
Was there, you know, I apologize, this is sort of a mundane question, but it often actually comes up and generates a useful answer. Was there something in particular in your own life that led you to start thinking about being wrong and being right?
You know, I wish I could say yes, you know, in the sense that I wish I could say, oh, you know, I was 29 years old and I suddenly found out that I had actually been adopted or something, you know, that I had some sort of catastrophic collapse of a major worldview that suddenly, you know, caused me to start thinking about rightness and wrongness in a new way, because it would be a great story. And unfortunately, that's not the case. I don't have some sort of single massive instance of wrongness that got me thinking about this book. I would say that I'm more, you know, instead of being wrong once in a really traumatic way, I'm just wrong constantly in kind of mundane ways. And that's more, I think, what got me thinking about it. And as I said initially, you know, thinking about how the attachment to being right and the real dread of being wrong plays out within our culture. And I will say that I started thinking about this book in the fall of 2004, which was right in the run-up to the presidential elections then. So certainly that political moment of just very entrenched, impassioned certainty on all sides, I think, was part of the kind of broth, if you will, that this idea marinated in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Close to our midpoint here, Catherine Schulz, our guest. She's a journalist. Her work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, The Nation, Foreign Policy, Huffington Post, among other places. She's former editor of the online magazine Grist, and she's the author of a newly published book. The title of her book is Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error, and Echo is the publisher. That's a HarperCollins imprint, and it's out now, and it's very interesting if you want to take a look at it. And I have an email here from someone who wondered whether you were familiar with a recent book by Robert Burton on being certain, which apparently looked at the sort of two things. One is is knowing things, and then the other is feeling that you know. And I guess those really are two different. Knowing something is one thing, but being convinced that you know something, that's something else. Are you familiar with this?
I am familiar both with Burton's book and with this idea, which is a crucial one, and I'm glad the listener emailed in to talk about it. I talk a lot about certainty and doubt in the book because I think they're very closely related to right and wrong and how we feel about being right and being wrong. And this notion that there's a distinction between feeling certain and being right is really important and surprisingly hard to deeply accept. The thing about certainty is that we often, it's an emotion, right? It's an emotional state, a psychological state, if you will. Psychologists have a way, you know, often talk about the feeling of knowing. It's just this sensation that you have the right answer, that you have the information, that you understand it. And we've all felt it. We feel it all the time. And it's incredibly convincing. You know, when you feel that you know something, you stop even entertaining doubt because that emotional state is so convincing. And what's hard to understand is that feeling of knowing is not necessarily accurate indicator of actually knowing it, of actually being right about something. Now, it's not an imperfect one. There's some correlation between feeling right and being right, but it's certainly not a perfect indicator either. And I talk at length in the book about examples where that feeling of knowing is so convincing that you can't imagine that it could lead you astray, and yet it does not correlate with what's really going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose there is also a big difference between knowing that you've been wrong and just finding it so painful to admit that you don't, and it never even entering into your head that you could possibly be wrong.
Right, exactly. I mean, there's the experience of realizing that you're wrong, and that's when all the emotion comes flooding in, right? That's when you're either kind of embarrassed and humiliated, or you're just surprised, or maybe it's funny or interesting. I mean, there's a whole range of emotional responses we can have to realizing that we're wrong. But realizing that we're wrong is very different from being wrong. Being wrong is just, you know, going around the world in a state that you're later on going to decide was erroneous. And I think a very, very crucial point is that that state of simply being wrong, not realizing it, but just being wrong, is completely indistinguishable from the state of feeling right. There's no internal indicator to suggest, oh, I'm wrong here. You're later going to realize you're wrong, but in the moment it feels exactly like being right. Hmm.
A caller here to talk with in Effingham on our line four. Hello.
Sounds to me like your guest is going round what Hegel and Marx understood about the dialectic. You understand that?
Well, I certainly understand a fair amount about Marx and the dialectic, and a moderate amount about Hegel. What do you have in mind particularly?
Well, doesn't that answer the questions and the thing that you are talking about? To find out one is wrong is not necessarily defeating. It means your synthesis was wrong. So you go back to square one.
I think that's right in the sense that one of the really valuable things about the experience of being wrong, and one of the reasons why I'm very pro being wrong, if you will, is that it's the mechanism by which we advance thought, whether it's political thought, as Marx was particularly thinking about it, or really almost any manner of belief about the world. Having that belief collapse is the opportunity to reconstruct knowledge. And in fact, it's pretty hard to imagine how we would learn and change and grow as successfully as we do without error as one of the major engines of that advancement. I mean, when you think about it, this is true even in the biological kingdom. You know, species evolve because of errors in the replication of genetic sequences. And without those errors, we don't get any kind of change. And without any kind of change, we're in a whole lot of trouble as a species. That's true on the level of DNA, and I think it's true on pretty much every other level of human existence as well.
Well, can I say one more thing, David?
Sure.
If the dialectic, then, as we have just spoken about, and being right or wrong, I think the evidence of 700 years is stifling that capitalism is wrong.
Well, all right. This is a favorite subject of the caller. I don't know if you want to say anything about capitalism or not. I do think that what's striking, and you have both said, is that error advances the state of our knowledge. And making mistakes is a good thing because it causes you to reexamine what you thought and maybe try to figure out where it is you went wrong. And that is, after all, how science works. And we like to tell our children that you can learn from your mistakes. I don't know, as adults, if we really believe that, but we tell kids that. Why is it, though, that it's so hard to embrace that view of error?
Well, you know, I think that quite a lot of it has to do with our cultural training, because many people are very successful at embracing that view of error. I mean, you bring up the example of scientists, and there's no question that science as a domain is really functions through an embrace of error and through the understanding that it is the falsification, the disproving of beliefs that advances the field. And if you look at engineers, or you look at people, I often bring up the example of aviation because they've done this pretty much more successfully than any other high-stakes field. People in aviation understand that you have got to accept that people are fallible and that mistakes happen, and that, in fact, the only way to understand our errors and you know, make it possible to not make them again and again and again is to do everything possible to bring them out in the open and make it okay to admit to errors. If you make people feel ashamed or humiliated or embarrassed about their mistakes, or if you make it clear that there's going to be some kind of actual negative consequence to them if they get things wrong, that they might be sued or they could lose their job or what have you. All you do is drive errors underground, if you will, and make it really impossible to understand why they happen and to create systems in which they can't happen. And in that sense, really the capacity to think about error in a less negative way, sort of more with this optimistic model that we were talking about earlier, is something that has to be created culturally, and it can be done because, as I said, it exists. I mean, you know, engineers live with a acute awareness of the likelihood of almost every process and they engage in and product they try to produce going wrong at some stage, and they think about error pretty obsessively, and they build the likelihood of it into their systems and just figure out ways to make sure the consequences of those errors don't have catastrophic mistakes. So it's very possible to cultivate a culture where error is acceptable, but in our day-to-day lives, and especially when more emotional issues are at stake or issues where there's not as clear of a feedback mechanism for whether something is right or wrong, we've not come a very long way in fostering that kind of culture.
Yeah. When you look at how human beings think, it's pretty clear, or at least it seems like it should be clear, that this didn't happen just by accident, that our thinking process, our and how we perceive the world and then what we do with that information had to have been shaped by environment over a long period of time. And you had to make the argument that so much of that, at least some point, had to have survival value or else it wouldn't have. So is there some way that you can connect the way that we think about error to our perceptions of the environment and really make this argument that, well, there are some things about this that maybe at least one time, maybe still, had survival value?
I mean, yes, I can make that argument, and I'll make it for you, but with the caveat that I'm not sure how convincing it is. I mean, if I were going to make that argument, it would go like this. It's really important to be right about our environment because, you know, understanding and swiftly interpreting the environment around us is crucial to staying alive. You know, if you're your own prehistoric ancestor and you hear some kind of rustling in the bushes, you need to be able to figure out very quickly whether it's dinner or it's your dinner. and getting that right really, is crucial to your survival. So you could argue that our shame and our sense of distaste around getting things wrong, you know, has to do with the powerful evolutionary imperative that we get certain kinds of things right. Now, personally, I think this is a little bit of a fishy argument, first of all, because none of us were around all those, you know, millennia ago to have any, you know, empirical evidence about whether or not this is true. But also because it just doesn't have a whole lot of relevance for our lives today. I mean, of course, it's still very important that we get certain things right in terms of our survival or not. But the survival value of being ashamed of our mistakes is close to non-existent in that, for the most part, any kind of negative emotion that's going to cause us to deny or ignore our mistakes is going to serve us very poorly. And again, the aviation example or the medical example brings that home very well. If we experience, humiliation and either internal or external punishment around our mistakes, we're never going to, you know, discuss them freely and openly and come up with a system whereby they don't happen again. So that's not good for our survival. The one thing I would say that I find a little compelling about the more evolutionary argument is I think there's probably something useful about the powerful emotional response we have to being wrong. I do think that being wrong is a wonderful way to learn, and that having a strong emotional reaction to our own mistakes might be part of how we encode new information. You know, it's not useful to encode, I'm a horrible human being because I made this mistake, but it might well be useful to encode a powerful response to an error so that you remember it and think about it and obsess over it until you come up with a better solution.
Hmm. Well, that's, I suppose, that again has to do with problem solving, maybe, and not wanting to be satisfied with something that didn't work out well, because and have something in you that pushes you to figure out, all right, this, we didn't get this right, but maybe we can if we just think about it in the right way, or try to do something, next time try to do it differently and see if it comes out better.
That's right, and to my mind, this is one of the real virtues of error, which is that if we can, you know, embrace it instead of it just trying to, you know, get as far away from it as we can because we're so embarrassed about our mistakes. I think it's a really wonderful engine of curiosity. You know, wow, that's weird. That is not what I was expecting at all. I thought X was going to happen, and instead Y happened. And, huh, I wonder how come, and what does that mean, and what can I learn from this? And curiosity, of course, is, you know, what drives us forward into the path of all kinds of, you know, exploration and discovery, whether, you know, in the sciences or the creative fields or what have you. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why, again, I really champion error, because I think it can bring us to those moments of revelation.
And that's something that you look at some of the research that's been done with very young children. That's really fascinating, because it says that that seems to be a tendency that we have, that is that if you put young kids in a situation and if something happens that is wildly different from what they expect, that's very exciting for them, and it motivates them to further explore and to have that same reaction, says, huh, that wasn't supposed to happen. What's going on here? And to become interested and curious, and you can make the argument that if humans didn't have that tendency, we wouldn't have gotten very far.
Right. I mean, certainly I think curiosity, although, you know, we have this popular phrase that it killed the cat, I do think it also, you know, keeps the cat alive and keeps the cat exploring and learning new things. And our species, of course, excels at that. And you're absolutely right. I mean, young children are vastly more interested when they're wrong about something than when they're right about something. And there's a ton of experimental research to back this up. And, you know, in a sense, you could almost think about it that young children are natural scientists. They play, and they essentially, in playing, they structure all these kinds of experiments about how the world works. And when things work out pretty much how they expect, kids get bored pretty quickly. But when things don't work out the way they think they're going to, when they have a belief and that belief is somehow violated or somehow collapsed or something happens that just completely contravenes it, they're fascinated. And they will explore and explore and explore and play and play and play in remarkably focused ways and in ways that completely defy our sense of the attention span of young children until they understand what's going on and they have a new theory about it. And I think that that's really, you know, I think, first of all, I think it's true for all of us that, or should be, that we are more engaged with our world when we're willing to let our knowledge horizons break down and push out farther and expand. And I also think it says some instructive things about how we probably should teach our children and structure our education as opposed to how we actually do, which tends to be a very correction-based model in which the whole point is to get things right.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with another caller. Spring Bay, line 4, right here. Hello.
Good morning. I think an interesting question, too, is what do we know versus what do we believe? And belief can color or determine what we think we know. And I've always thought that our greatest challenge, I suppose, is to try to remain free of ideology and look at the world, you know, and try to discover reality. But ideologies, oftentimes, people have an ideology and then they want to cram subconsciously reality to fit the ideology. An interpretation of stimulus or stimuli then becomes a factor of making that stimulus adhere to our previously held assumptions or beliefs. And I'll get off and listen to your comments.
Talk about belief.
Sure, I'm happy to. It's a great point the caller makes. In fact, it's a lot of great points. There's no question that ideology colors what we think that we know and what we think we're right about and our capacity to tolerate or entertain the possibility that we're wrong. That said, ideology is not just something that, you know, those wackos out there on the political fringes hold or what have you. All of us have very extensive pre-existing belief systems about the world. And that's fine. We need them. We can't actually get through life without some sort of theory structure that's helping us make sense of the world around us. The trick, and it's a pretty tricky one, is to still be flexible in the face of new evidence. Because one of the very dangerous things about all of our pre-existing theories is that they systematically make it very, very hard for us to pay any attention to counter-evidence. We often simply don't even see the counter-evidence. We don't come into contact with it because it's beyond our purview and we sort of don't venture there. Or we see it and we just immediately disregard it and think it's unimportant. Or, you know, we actually bother to look at it and nonetheless decide that it can't possibly be right. In other words, the whole effect of having a theory about the world is to make it very, very difficult to entertain the possibility that your theory is wrong. And there's a lot of practical reasons for this. As I said, it helps us get through life, but it does form a, you know, really major impediment to facing up to our errors and also simply to facing up to challenges to our beliefs. And, you know, I would also say that, you know, one of the really interesting things about the experience of being wrong is that in that moment, what we think was knowledge collapses into just belief, right? Like we thought something was a, you know, irrefutable fact about the world. And when we realize that we were wrong, we have to face up to the fact that, you know, no, that was it felt like knowledge, but it was actually just an erroneous belief that we held deeply, which gets back to the distinction between the feeling of knowing versus actually knowing something. And one thing that I do in the book is I look very closely at the category of knowledge and the category of belief and, you know, whether or not there's ultimately anything that we can put into that first category and feel completely confident about, or whether, in fact, one of the lessons of wrongness is that there's probably some situation in which almost every conviction we have about the world could turn out to be erroneous.
That's pretty discomforting.
Well, it is and it isn't. You know, I think that it's discomforting if you take it so much to heart that you let it paralyze you. This is why skepticism with a capital S is a pretty unsatisfying philosophical position. You know, no one can get through life thinking every move I make could be wrong, every belief I hold could be wrong. In that sense, sure, of course, it's, you know, if you take it to an extreme, it is discomforting.
Yeah.
And on some level, I think all of us crave certainty and order, and we want to know what's going to happen next, and we want to know that we can place our confidence in our beliefs and in the world around us, and we hate the idea of randomness, we hate the idea of not being able to control the world around us, and yet randomness and lack of control are really pretty much a part of life. And in that sense, you know, there's something that actually I think is very comforting about the fact that any of our beliefs could collapse out from under us and prove to be wrong, in that I do think it reminds us that, you know, things don't just prove wrong. They prove wrong because there's a new body of information out there and there's a new set of facts or a new way to arrange them, and suddenly the world looks totally different. And sure, I think for many people the experience of reshuffling the deck that way can be pretty unnerving, and yet I also think it's one of the most exciting and wonderful experiences we can have while we're alive.
Our guest, Catherine Schultz, her new book is Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error, and we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. We have a caller in Chicago. We'll talk with them on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you. The thinking can be very thoughtful when you stop to think about it, if you want to take the time to stop to think about it. But so much of the fast-paced society we live in, we rush through so many situations of making decisions immediately or an impulse and emotional and moral factors. And I'm reminded of beliefs in the past where we had a flat earth mentality going back before Columbus and others explored the world and discovered it was round, or Galileo, and observing how the earth revolves around the sun rather than the thinking that went on that felt that all the universe revolved around the earth. So so many factors go into our observation and determination of how we make decisions and hold on to those beliefs, who knows, endlessly or quickly. But the area of neuroscience and technology and communication has certainly opened up a vast horizon and view of how we go into the matter of making decisions. And I recently read the book How We Decide, which employs the interaction of neuroscience and cognitive behavior into and all the other personal emotional factors into our decision making. And I found that your views to be very, very great in enhancing that perspective. Thank you very, very much.
All right. I don't know. You want to comment on that any way you like?
Yeah, first of all, yes, Joan Allaire's book, How We Decide, is a wonderful look at the sort of neurobiology underlying the choices that we make in everyday lives. And when you write about how we make choices, you inevitably have to think about how and why we get them wrong. And he does some of that work in the book, and he does do it specifically from that neuroscientific perspective. And I think it's a really interesting and valuable one. In my own book, I look both at the biological and neurological underpinnings of error and our relationship to it, but also at its cultural and social and even its historical context, because I think those factors are very important as well in terms of understanding, you know, how did we as a culture arrive at the views about error that we have? How and why do we as individuals feel the way that we do in the face of our mistakes? And as your caller points out, there are many, many, many factors that go into every decision we make and every belief we form, and those range from our senses, you know, things as simple as our perceptions of the world around us, to the way that our minds work on a very technical level in terms of how we sort through and make sense of information, to the kinds of societies we live in and the influence those have on our beliefs. So one of the things that I seek to do is look at all of those factors and the role that they play in our relationship to wanting to be right and dealing with being wrong.
You know, I something I think is interesting doing this job, we look at a lot of books, and we look at a lot of book reviews, and we get releases, and we get tons and tons of review copies and books, and it does seem that things kind of go in waves, you know. And it does seem that recently here there have been a lot of books written for popular readers that one way or another have to do with human cognition, things like how the brain works, and particularly how it is that how it is we perceive the world, and how our perceptions and how the brain works deceives us, how it is we often get fooled, and how often it is that we are wrong about the world. And I think that that's very interesting. I don't know if it means anything that at this point there seem to be a lot of books kind of about that. Do you think that that says anything?
I share your fascination with this phenomenon. I think for a long time we've had books about how the mind works in various ways. You know, Oliver Sacks, Steven Pinker, there's people who've been around for decades, and I mean certainly much more than that. I can go back to William James, writing about how the mind works. But I think you're exactly right that we seem to be living in a moment where there's specifically a lot of books about wrongness kind of broadly interpreted, books about decision-making. I'm thinking of both Joan Allaire's book that we mentioned earlier and Sheena Iyengar's book on choice, The Art of Choosing. There's books about being fooled by randomness. There's books about experts and whether they get it right or wrong. So there does seem to be this interesting zeitgeist right now that is one of a certain kind of awareness that we have the capacity to get it wrong. And I'm fairly heartened by that. I think it's probably good that we are taking a step back and looking at our fallibility for whatever reason. I don't know exactly what's bringing it about. I have a sneaking suspicion that I was not alone in incubating some of these ideas beginning in 2004 at a moment of intense political division in our country, but I certainly, you know, have no grounds to back that up. One thing that I'll say that I feel like I wish were more present within that this dialogue that's emerging and that I really try to push in my book is a notion that the point about fallibility isn't how do we stop being fallible. You know, I think that a certain number of these books are really looking at how we get things wrong in the interest of trying to get things right more often. And that's a perfectly reasonable goal, and I don't want to disparage it. But I don't think it's the whole picture, in part because there are many situations in which we're never going to get things right all the time. In fact, most situations. And there's also, I think, something, as I've said, destructive about trying to eradicate rather than embrace our fallibility, because it really is sort of part of the bargain we get with being human.
Well, and it seems that I don't know that any of these books really have as the premise that by having a better understanding of how the brain works, or of how perception work, or of how we think, that doesn't necessarily mean that we can do it differently. There's sort of no undoing that, but at the same time, there's also this kind of idea that, you know, it's maybe not such a bad thing to at least be kind of at some level to try to be aware of that, not but not that you can something that's so fundamental as how we think, it's not something that we're going to change.
Well, I think we can change certain things, and I think that's part of where this literature comes from, is a certain excitement around, hey, we've identified these predictable patterns in how we think, and maybe we can correct for them. And I think that that's true. I think that, in fact, one of the few consistent findings in how to be a little bit more right, if that's your goal, is you need to be able to engage in what psychologists call metacognition. You need to be able to think about how you think, because there are traps that we all fall into in terms of, you know, do we or don't we entertain counter evidence? Are we or are we not able to recognize the limitations of our own thought patterns? And being aware of those things really actually can make you a more critical thinker. Now, that's not to say you're going to get things right all the time, or even that you should, given that, you know, here we are talking about error as this wonderful engine of learning and change. But I think it can help you kind of cut off at the pass some of the more predictable mistakes that all of us make as human beings and become a little bit more analytical and a little bit of a sharper thinker. And that, I, of course, think is a good thing, although I don't support the kind of larger goal of eradicating error in general or writing it off as some sort of horrible, you know, nasty pest that we should all be trying to get rid of.
Well, and it also, I guess I find myself going back to this notion that we go through life having certain expectations, and that if they weren't upset sometimes, life would be kind of boring. Really, and that you should, I suppose, think about all those times that when your expectations were radically upset, well, you know, was that really a distressing thing, or was that actually kind of a pleasurable thing? Probably there will be some of both. Maybe you can hope that it was more pleasurable than it was distressing.
Or that, you know, with the passage of time, it will come to seem really important, even if it was distressing in the moment. But, you know, I share that perspective completely. And I think often you asked earlier if there's something in my own life that made me write this book. And there certainly isn't a single incident. But one thing that I think was influential is that, you know, I have a background in international journalism, and I've done a fair amount of traveling. And one of the things I really cherish about travel is that, you know, boy, does it remind you of your fallibility. You know, you get things wrong practically hourly when you're in another country, in another culture, where you don't understand how even the most basic things work. And that kind of wrongness, to me, is so eye-opening and teaches us so much about the world, about ourselves, about the culture we're in, but also the culture we came from. And I think that, life would be incredibly boring without those kinds of, you know, collapsing and reconstructing of belief that we hopefully engage in as much as we can.
Our guest, Catherine Schultz, her book is Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. Echo is the publisher. She's a journalist. Her work has appeared in many places, New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, Nation, Foreign Policy, Huffington Post. She's also a former editor of the online magazine Grist. And thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue. So please stay tuned.
WILL programs are made possible by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal Street in Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets on this Wednesday morning, where U.S. grain and soybean futures are trading higher, moving into the final hours of trade today, sustaining the electronic strength that we saw overnight, and also building on that a little bit in the open outcry trading session. Wheat certainly is the leader to the upside on optimism that come Friday, Russia could curb its exports at an ag ministry meeting either either through tariffs or some other means. Also, word that Saudi Arabia is in the wheat market for about 550,000 metric tons of wheat as well. Corn futures are being led higher by, of course, the continued talk about the drought, and soybean prices are being firm through strong demand. We saw Taiwan in the market yesterday for supplies for over a year, as they're beginning to wonder.